This is RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On Air.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we're journeying into the realms of sci-fi and fantasy fiction. Philip Reeve describes a future universe ruled by search engines and crisscrossed by steam engines.
Planets are linked by railways, by trains which zip through some kind of hyperspace portal and can take you from one planet to the next.
I discover some great sci-fi and fantasy in the Talking Books library.
The Corova milk bar was a milk plus mesto, and you may, oh my brothers, have forgotten what these mestos were like. Things changing so scurry these days, and everybody very quick to forget. Newspapers not being read much neither.
And Neil Gaiman speaks exclusively to Read On Air about his latest fantastic project.
History and religion and myth combine, and we wonder and we imagine and we guess like detectives, reconstructing the details of a long-forgotten crime.
That's all coming up in today's show. A new wave of science fantasy is sweeping the publishing world, particularly young adult fiction. Authors like Philip Reeve are at the forefront. His best-selling Mortal Engines series is set in a post-apocalyptic world in which cities have been mechanized to move and attack each other in competition for dwindling resources, a system known as municipal Darwinism. Now he's back with a new series, Railhead, which was shortlisted for the 2017 Silip Carnegie Medal. It's a brilliant concept that I can only describe as Blade Runner meets Thomas the Tank Engine, but it's best that you hear all about it from its creator.
"What do you want with me?" shouted Zen. "I haven't done anything wrong. I was just..."
"It would be a bad idea to waste my time," said the Rail Force man. "Where is Raven?"
Zen blinked. "Is this about the necklace? That girl? Is she one of your people?"
"This is not about a necklace. Where is Raven?"
Railhead is a fantastic concept. I've given a taste of what it is, but could you tell the audience a little bit more about the background to the book?
Yes, Railhead is set in the far distant future when human beings live on all sorts of different planets scattered all over the galaxy. And the planets are linked by railways, by trains which zip through some kind of hyperspace portal and can take you from one planet to the next. So it's basically a railway-based space opera, and a whole sort of empire has grown up around these the railway stations on the various worlds. And on one of the planets lives a young lad called Zen Starling, who is a sort of a thief and a ne'er-do-well. And early on in the book, he's hired by a character called Raven to steal a particular object from the Emperor's art collection. And, of course, it turns out, as such things always do, to be much more dangerous and important than he had imagined. So that's where the story starts.
And it's a book that's full of humour and the joy of ideas and discovery. I love the fact that we have sentient trains travelling faster between universes than spaceships can, and so spaceships have pretty much fallen out of use and people take the train everywhere.
Yes, trains are very very exotic and high tech, and in this world they don't have drivers. They're intelligent machines, and they kind of look after themselves, and each locomotive has its own personality. And yes, spaceships of course are regarded as very kind of run-of-the-mill and not very interesting at all.
I wouldn't call it a dystopian book. I think it's more hopeful than that. Did you set out to write something that wasn't dark and terrible like Blade Runner, but actually was a little bit more akin to, I don't know, the culture novels of Ian M. Banks?
Yes, I didn't really know the culture novels, in fact, until people started saying, "Oh, Railhead is very like those." So I went and read one. And I guess there are some similarities. My future isn't quite as utopian as that. But I did definitely want to not write a dystopia. I think there have been quite enough dystopias, thank you, in recent years. There's been a bit of a craze for them, and I'm kind of bored with them. And I also find them a bit limiting. I wanted to imagine a world that is more like the real world, in that it has nice bits and nasty bits. And, of course, it's quite important that you have both, because my hero starts off living in a rather grimy, grotty corner of the universe, and he wants to escape from it, and that's kind of what drives the story. That's what motivates him to do the things he does, is to better himself. So I needed some sort of different levels of society like that. But yes, on the whole, I think it's a very nice future. It's a future I'd like to live in. Most people are having a great time.
It definitely feels linked to our present.
Yes, I mean, I think any decent science fiction is really about the present rather than the future. It has to be. It's only going to be of interest if it casts some light on the world we live in.
I was going to ask, I mean, it's a very visual future. I, as a blind person myself, I was struck by how you blink at things that appear on your headset to scroll through menus and to find information. And having tried Google Glass, I found that impossible to use as a blind person. Do you think there's any room for blind people in the future that you've written about?
Well, to be honest, I think medical technology will have advanced to such a point in a society like this that there wouldn't really be any reason for anyone to be blind unless they chose to be. Equally, headset technology I'm talking about, it's kind of transmitting stuff straight into people's optic nerves, so that would presumably be a way around blindness. I'm talking about a world where technology can kind of solve most problems.
And I certainly wouldn't want you to think that I felt it was an exclusive book in any way, because actually, I know that you started as an illustrator and a writer, and I felt that you paint wonderful world pictures. I've often wondered how graphic novels could translate into prose. And I could see the engines that you were describing and Cleve B Station. Do you think, having come from an illustration background, that makes you a more descriptive writer?
I don't know. I mean, there are plenty of very descriptive writers who I don't think do come from an illustration background or an art background, but it's certainly always been the case for me. My two loves when I was growing up were, you know, pictures and stories, and I like to combine the two. And I did become an illustrator, but it was much more a sort of cartoony style of illustration that I was doing. I wouldn't really have been capable of drawing a picture of the kind of things I'm describing in Railhead.
Quite apart from a rather sort of cyberpunk or steampunk world that you create, you also raise some quite thorny questions about the nature of autonomy. I mean, there are drones and motorics or androids who do the dirty work and the dangerous work for the human beings. And there are the guardians, who are beings of pure information, who I sort of equated to Google and other search engines, I think, who possibly might be feeding fake news or at least edited versions of the news to the human beings. So it's a very thoughtful book in that respect.
Well, I'm glad you thought so. I don't really sort of set out to write about themes and issues and things, but if you tell a story, then quite often they kind of creep in, and you can look back at it when you've finished and go, "Ooh, look, a subtext or whatever." And yes, when I look back at this one, there's a kind of recurring thing about non-human intelligences. You know, that human beings share this future with androids who are pretty much like humans but mechanical, and then there are the trains who are kind of a different level of being altogether, and then above them all there are the guardians, who are these sort of vast artificial intelligence systems, which I think you're right have probably evolved from things like Google. You know, they're some sort of future iteration of the big search engines and things that we have now, but they're basically gods. They have the power of gods, and they kind of rule over human society in a godlike way. And they're basically benign, which is why it's such a nice society. You know, they're basically trying to keep everything stable and running along smoothly and making sure there aren't any wars or anything like that. But yes, that does involve sometimes putting the wool over our eyes a bit. And like, you know, the Greek gods, they're quite sort of envious of each other, and they have their favorites and their little feuds and stuff. So that does generate a certain amount of the narrative.
Zen said defiantly, "I don't know what you're on about." The man looked past him again. "Maybe he's not made contact yet. Did you learn anything from the drone?" "Fried," said one of the others. "Sorry, Captain Malik, it self-destructed before we could get anything out of it." Captain Malik gave a cold smile. "Raven hides his tracks well."
One of the more fascinating sets of characters in the book, I thought, were the Hive Monks.
Yes, the Hive Monks are, and I don't really know where this idea comes from exactly, except that I'm nervous of insects. I'm vaguely phobic about most creepy crawlies. So sometimes, you know, it's nice to write about things you like, but it's also very good to write about things you don't like, because all sorts of good imagery and ideas can be lurking there. And the Hive Monks are, they're basically, there are some sort of mutated beetle-like insects in this future galaxy, and if enough of them get together, they form a kind of group intelligence, a hive mind. So of course, being a hive mind, they have their own little personality, and they kind of want to be part of society. So they all scramble together, and they make themselves a kind of an armature out of bits of old stick and chicken bones and wire and string, and turn themselves, you know, clamber onto it and turn themselves into this sort of vaguely human shaped mass of insects. But obviously nobody wants to talk to a vaguely human-shaped mass of insects. So they make themselves kind of tatty robes, monk-like robes, hence the name Hive Monks. And they wander the stations and the railways on some strange, endless pilgrimage of their own. They have some insect religion that leads them to keep traveling and traveling on the trains. And, of course, nobody stops. Nobody would throw a Hive Monk off a train, because if they get agitated, they kind of tend to panic and turn back into a great swarm of insects again. So they're these rather odd, strange, outcast kind of characters. It's very hard to write anything original in science fiction or fantasy, and I'm sure there are loads of examples of people made out of loads of insects. I think Dracula does that at one point. But I think the difference of the Hive Monks is that they're actually all right. You know, they can be quite friendly and helpful if you can bear to get near them.
You have to embrace what you dislike to make progress. For all the serious questions that I've asked, there's an awful lot of fun and a rollicking plot to this book. I love the sort of small touches of referring back to science fiction that we all know, and that the suggestion that Klingon might have been an ancient Earth language. I found myself laughing a lot through Railhead.
Good, I'm glad. Yes, I think science fiction, even when it's being serious, it's a very playful kind of genre, which is what I like about it. I think that you can make serious points and explore serious issues, and tell an exciting plot and still have jokes, basically, or fun at least. So yeah, that was very important to me, that it should have that kind of quality to it.
And I believe that the sequel, The Black Light Express, has already been published in hardback.
Yes, that came out in hardback last year, and it will be out in paperback sometime this summer. And I'm working on a third, which is pretty much finished, and that will be published next year sometime. The first book, Railhead, is an audiobook, which is read by Malk Williams very well. And the second one, I hope, will be, but I don't actually have a release date for that yet.
Oh, well, I shall very, very much look forward to them both turning up in the Talking Books library. There's a wonderful sentence that Zen says towards the end of the book, and it doesn't offer any spoilers, but I think it offers an insight into the pace of the book, that everyone's riding on a runaway train. And I just love the concept that life is a runaway train.
As you get into the very final stages of a book, hopefully it's sort of like a wave lifts you up and carries you to the shore. And I start to write much, much faster, and all sorts of ideas I didn't know I had come out. And that's one of them, basically. I guess I was trying to suggest that there was some kind of plan behind the whole thing and some kind of, overarching metaphor, which I hadn't really had in mind at all when I was writing it. I was just trying to be exciting and fun. But yes, I guess the idea of the runaway train, that's sort of how Zen's life certainly is, and I guess it's how all our lives are. Yes, I guess having written a whole book about trains, I had to in some way suggest that there was something kind of universal about them.
Philip Reeve, thank you so much for being my guest on Read On Air, and I look forward to interviewing you when the third book in the series comes out.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
Thanks to Philip Reeve. A wide selection of his books is available in a range of formats from the RNIB library, including Mortal Engines, read by Kenneth Branagh. Railhead is currently available as a commercial audiobook. Giant print, braille and synthetic voice version can all be found in the RNIB library, thanks to a long-standing arrangement with the organisers of the Silip Carnegie Medal. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. This week, we're exploring the realms of science fiction and fantasy. But first,
one of the joys of my days back as an audiobook producer was when we got to work on a great sci-fi or fantasy book. So here, in no particular order, are some of my favourites. And if you recognise the music, you'll know the first book is by Arthur C. Clarke, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
No matter how many times you left Earth, Dr. Hayward Floyd told himself, the excitement never really palled. He had been to Mars once, to the moon three times, and to the various space stations more often than he could remember. Yet, as the moment of takeoff approached, he was conscious of a rising tension, a feeling of wonder and awe, yes, and of nervousness, which put him on the same level as any Earth lover about to receive his first baptism of space.
The drought has lasted for 10 million years. Man is heading for extinction when one group of primates is singled out to receive information that will speed up their development. They learn to kill in order to survive. Years later, men dig up a monolith on the moon, and it launches itself into deep space. Read by Christopher Saul, it lasts 7 hours 38 minutes, and many of the sequels and other books by Arthur C. Clarke are also available from RNIB. Next up, A Clockwork Orange.
The Corova milk bar was a milk plus mesto, and you may, oh my brothers, have forgotten what these mestos were like. Things changing so scurry these days, and everybody very quick to forget. Newspapers not being read much neither.
In Anthony Burgess's book, 15-year-old Alex and his three friends start an evening's mayhem by hitting an old man, tearing up his books and stripping him of money and clothes because of his delinquent excesses. Alex is jailed and made subject to a chilling experiment in reclamation treatment. The unique language in this book is read by Ben Crystal, and it lasts 6 hours 26 minutes. For something a little more light-hearted, Doctor Who and the Loch Ness Monster.
Swiftly, the Doctor spun the locking wheel, hauled open the door and climbed into the chamber. Kneeling by Sarah, he lifted her head and shoulders. Sarah's eyes snapped open and she parted her lips to scream in blind panic. The Doctor shook her gently. "It's all right, Sarah, it's me." Sarah shook her head confusedly. "Doctor, I was talking to you on the telephone and then I saw this thing." She struggled to sit up. "What about Harry? Is he all right?" "I'm afraid he's disappeared." "Oh, no." Suddenly she broke off. "Doctor, doctor, look!" The heavy metal door of the decompression chamber was swinging closed.
Doctor Who and the Loch Ness Monster stars the Doctor as portrayed by Tom Baker. After three oil rigs are destroyed in the vicinity of Loch Ness, Doctor Who is summoned to solve the mystery and stop the sabotage. It's read by Gabriel Wolfe, lasts 3 hours, 4 minutes, and it's one of many Doctor Who books available from RNIB Talking Books, spanning every Doctor up to and including Matt Smith. And now, the beginning of an epic, Foundation One by Isaac Asimov.
Extract. A further necessary assumption is that the human conglomerate be itself unaware of psychohistoric analysis in order that its reactions be truly random. Extract. The basis of all valid psychohistory lies in the development of the Selden functions, which exhibit properties congruent to those of such social and economic forces as... From the Encyclopedia Galactica.
The time is a future century in the days of the Galactic Empire. The old empire is crumbling into barbarism, and Harry Selden and his band of psycho-historians foresee only anarchy, unless they can create a new force, the Foundation, dedicated to art, science and technology, the nucleus of a new empire. Read by Arthur Blake. Foundation Book 1 lasts for 8 hours and 21 minutes. And all of the other Foundation series books are available from RNIB, as well as some Asimov classics such as I, Robot, and just in the latest issue of New Books, you'll find The Naked Sun. Now let's go old school to possibly one of the first science fiction books ever written, Jules Verne's From the Earth to the Moon.
The astronomical, mechanical, and topographical difficulties resolved, finally came the question of finance. The sum required was far too great for any individual, or even any single state, to provide the requisite millions. President Barbicane undertook, despite the matter being a purely American affair, to render it one of universal interest, and to request the financial cooperation of all peoples. It was, he maintained, the right and the duty of the whole Earth to interfere in the affairs of its satellite.
It's the year 1865, following the end of the American Civil War. The members of the Baltimore Gun Club are restless, seeking new ways of using their genius for invention and discovery. So their president, M.P. Barbicane, sets his fellows a challenge to construct a rocket which can reach the moon. There are many Jules Verne books available in the library. This one is narrated by Garrick Hagan and it lasts 5 hours and 34 minutes. There are also many books in the library narrated by Garrick Hagan. And you may be interested to know, since we're on the subject of science fiction, he played Biggs in the original Star Wars film. And in the Tim Burton version of Batman, he played Batman's dad. Although, if you know the story, you'll know he wasn't in the film for very long. But staying at the cinema, Mockingjay, Hunger Games, Part 3.
We're overdue for a level 5 security drill, says Coin. Let's proceed with lockdown. She begins to type rapidly on her keyboard, authorizing her decision. The moment she raises her head, it begins.
Against all odds, Katniss has survived the Hunger Games twice, but now she's made it out of the bloody arena alive. She's still not safe. The capital is angry, and the capital wants revenge. Mockingjay by Suzanne Collins is read by Julie Rogers and lasts 11 hours and 26 minutes.
They've found her, my lord! Ned rose quickly. Omen or Lannisters? It was Jory. Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendour in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The North went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone, but a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather, and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking book number 19231.
Tell Jory to bring her here at once. I am sorry, my lord, Poole told him. The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the Queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the King.
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Next, a book that almost everyone must know the twist at the end, but we won't reveal it here. Trust me, you'll know it. Planet of the Apes.
The orangutans hate you, because you are the living proof of their scientific aberrations, and the gorillas consider you too dangerous to be left in liberty much longer. They are frightened you might found a new race on this planet. But apart from this eventuality, they are frightened your mere example might sow unrest among the men.
In a spaceship that can travel at the speed of light, Ulysses, a journalist, sets off from Earth for the nearest solar system. He finds there a planet which resembles his own, but on Soror, humans behave like animals and are hunted by a civilized race of primates. Captured and sent to a research facility, Ulysses must convince the apes of their mutual origins. But such revelations will always be greeted by prejudice and fear. Planet of the Apes was originally written in French by Pierre Boulle, who also wrote The Bridge Over the River Kwai. It's narrated by Greg Wise and lasts for 5 hours and 55 minutes.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
And now for our final 3, volumes 1, 2 and 3 of Star Trek.
Put me through to Captain Daly, the Astro Queen, on orbit station, and put it on scramble.
Yes, sir. He's on, sir.
John, this is Jim Kirk. Can you do me a little favor?
I owe you a dozen, Daly's voice said. And 2 dozen drinks, too. Name your poison.
Thanks. I want you to pass up your pickup here.
You mean strand all them actors?
Just that, Kirk said. I'll take them on. And if there's any trouble, the responsibility is mine.
Will do.
I appreciate it. I'll explain later, I hope. Over and out. Lieutenant Uhura, now I want the library computer.
Library.
Reference the CODIS file. I'm told there are 8 or 9 survivors of the massacre who were actual eyewitnesses. I want their names and status.
Working. In order of age, Layton T., deceased. Molson E., deceased.
Wait a minute, I want survivors.
These were survivors of the massacre,
the computer said primly.
The deceased are all recent murder victims. All cases open. Instructions.
Kirk swallowed. Continue.
Spend over 77 hours exploring the final frontier. Volume 1 looks at the first season and includes episodes such as The Naked Time, Shore Leave, Space Seed and The City on the Edge of Forever. It's narrated by Bill DeFreeze and lasts 22 hours 56 minutes. Volume 2 is from the second season and includes The Trouble with Tribbles, Mirror Mirror and A Mock Time. It's narrated by Hayward Morse, and it lasts for 25 hours and 9 minutes. And finally, 24 tales from scripts from the third season in Volume 3, including The Paradise Syndrome and The Empath. Again, this one's narrated by Hayward Morse, and lasts for 21 hours and 42 minutes. All the books mentioned are available from RNIB Talking Books, and you can download them via RNIB Overdrive. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk/library or phone the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to Robert. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, that exclusive interview with Neil Gaiman.
This is an RNIB talking book.
I love talking books. I don't know what my life would be without them. I love travel books. I love all the people that travel the world and tell us what they've done. It's the one freedom I really have, is to read the books that I love and people doing things in the world, you just get absolutely drawn into the story. And it's difficult to get to your bed sometimes. I think Talking Books is the best thing ever.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Neil Gaiman is one of the biggest names in fantasy fiction. He's won international acclaim for his comic book series The Sandman and for novels such as American Gods and The Graveyard Book, and notched up numerous TV, film and radio successes. Our reporter, Hannah Tauss, caught up with Neil Gaiman at the Hay Festival and obtained this exclusive interview. Sit back and enjoy a fascinating insight into the world of a master storyteller.
Gods of the Vanir, like the sister and brother Freya and Frey, live in Asgard with the Aesir. History and religion and myth combine, and we wonder and we imagine and we guess like detectives, reconstructing the details of a long-forgotten crime.
Norse mythology, it's your latest book. How much of a challenge is it to take these kind of great classic epics and turn it into modern prose?
There's two answers, and they're both true, one of which is not much of a challenge at all, and the other is it was really, really difficult. But what was difficult was figuring out the voice that I needed to tell the stories in, or actually the voice that I was going to retell the stories in, because I'm taking stories from the prose Edda of Snorri and from the poetic Edda, I'm taking things that are poems, taking things that are very dry descriptions of what happened. And the task then becomes figuring out the voice. And it probably took me as long to work out the kind of voice I wanted to tell these stories in as it did to write them, which is in each case several years. Once I had the voice in my head, then it was a joy. I would write a story between projects. So every time I finished a screenplay or handed in a book or whatever, I would then write one of my... It was like having knitting. You know, I have aunts who keep knitting in their handbags at all times. And when nothing's going on, they take it out and they do some knitting. And Norse mythology was my knitting.
There are so many Norse stories we do not have, so much we do not know. All we have are some myths that have come to us in the form of folktales, in retellings, in poems, in prose. They were written down when Christianity had already displaced the worship of the Norse gods. And some of the stories we have came to us because people were concerned that if the stories were not preserved, some of the kennings, the usages of poets that referred to events in specific myths, would become meaningless. Freya's tears, for example, was a poetic way of saying gold.
And I loved the idea. I think one of the things that drove me was a weird kind of dualistic thing. I loved the idea of reaching somebody who was like I was, age 7, aged 8, aged 9, aged 10, who was waiting for these stories to enter their life but didn't know it yet. And I also wanted to reach adults, either who had encountered these stories as children but wanted to now read them again, or again, who had never really encountered them, and I wanted to build a cycle, build a pattern, take these stories and go, okay, I'm going to take you from creation through to Armageddon, through to Ragnarok, the end of everything, and take you just a little bit after that. And I'm not going to make stuff up in the strict sense. If something, I may embroider, I may tell a story, I may add corroborative detail, and I may go, okay, if I was telling you this story and it was 1200 years ago when we're sitting around a fire and we've all eaten, and now I'm going to tell you this story, I will. And I'm going to try and do it in terms that would probably all work for somebody in the 8th or 9th century. I'm not necessarily going to... I'm not going to use modern analogies. Something is not going to be the size of a lorry or whatever. Getting that to work was an absolute delight and occasionally a frustration. But when I finished it, I got to step back and go, okay, I think I did something new and something fun with the myths and something nobody's quite done before. And the reaction and the response to it has been terrifyingly gratifying.
Do you have any connection with visual impairment or sight loss?
I don't, you know, apart from the fact that from my perspective, it's definitely, as I head into middle age, late middle age now, have to come to terms with a world in which everybody is writing things down smaller and smaller and fuzzier. I did a signing last night, and there was actually a point where somebody had written their name down, and I said, who am I signing it for? And she said, for me, and pointed to what she had written. And I was like, what does it say?
Do you have any difficulty at all with your publishers in trying to encourage them to do large print books or audio recordings?
Yeah, no, I've always said yes to everything. I mean, my position on doing stuff for the blind, for the visually impaired, has always been we say yes. And that's yes to allowing people to read the stories on tape in the old days. That's yes to making sure that people have access to the professional recordings wherever possible. That's yes to large print books and large print editions. And actually, interestingly, it was also yes to heading onto the Kindle back in 2007. Where I remember being given a trial Kindle by Amazon and going, well, it's really ugly and everything about this is kind of clunky. But the fact that I can change the font size to something that is comfortable for me, and I know my dad can change the font size to something that is comfortable for him, this is going to be the killer app. It's going to be an app that is actually going to be driven by people. Normally, apps get driven by the young. And on that one, I went, no, this is going to be driven by the middle-aged and older who see it as freedom from the large print book selection, because anything can be a large print book now.
You've written both graphic novels, comics, and the more traditional book format. How difficult is it to switch between the two aspects, one where you don't need many words and one where everything has to be described?
Well, everything has to be described anyway. It's just whether or not you, as the person reading it, are reading my descriptions or not. I could be describing things for a reader to build a picture in her head, or I can be describing things for an artist to draw a picture for the reader. When I was writing Sandman as a monthly comic, I think there were probably about 2,500 words per issue in terms of what you would see in captions and word balloons. But each Sandman script was about 10,000 words long. So you were getting approximately, you know, 4 pages of description where I'm just saying, okay, page 17, panel 3, this is what we're looking at. And you're doing that for an artist.
Some of your heroes tend to be quite unexpected, or should I say unsuspecting. What is it that appeals to you about writing that sort of hero?
I think that one of the lovely things to do with protagonists is to start going, okay, what would it be like if it was me? Or not me, but necessarily what would it be like if it was a 9-year-old girl version of me? What would it be like if this happened to somebody I knew? And all of a sudden, you wind up with a different class of hero. You wind up with the kind of protagonists who actually do have to outthink their way because they're definitely not going to be able to outpunch their way through a story.
It's a beautiful way of putting it. You're brought up in Britain, of course, moved to America. Which culture has the strongest influence on what you write?
I think the UK culture has the strongest influence on what I write. People ask me, you know, are you a British or an American writer? And I explain, for the purpose of their essays, I'm whatever you want. It doesn't matter. If you want to write an essay on me as an American writer, that's fine. I've won American awards and I've lived there for about 25 years. But the literature that formed me, which I think is weirdly the most important thing, is British. Even though, you know, P.L. Travers, who wrote the Mary Poppins books, was Australian. But there is something in terms of style. C.S. Lewis, off in Northern Ireland. But it's that style. It's P.G. Wodehouse. The people who shaped me when I was too young to realize they were shaping me, I think are probably the most important writers there.
And what about your children? How have they influenced what you write? I know you've got grown-up children, you've also got a young son. How has it shaped your books? And are they critical of them?
Well, I don't think that I would have been a children's writer as well if it wasn't for having kids, which had more to do with the desperate need to try and demonstrate to my children that I did actually have a proper job. And I remember when my son Mike, who's now 33, was about 12, he sort of sidled over to me one day and said, "Why don't you write anything good?" And I said, "What do you mean, why don't I write anything good?" He said, "Why don't you write anything that me and my friends want to read?" I said, "Well, what do you want to read?" And he said, "We read X-Men, you know, you write comics and they're all stupid." And I said, "Well, you know, stick around 3 or 4 years and I'll be cool." He said, "What are you going to write?" And I said, "Well, the same stuff, but honestly, in 3 or 4 years, I'll be cool." But there was a definite realization at that point that it was time to, for example, finish Coraline, which I had started years earlier for my kids and had just sort of got swept away because there was so much to do. So I finished Coraline. And the Graveyard book, which I actually began in my head for Mike when he was like 2 years old, got finished when he was in his 20s. There's a level on which I don't think I would have been as enthusiastic a writer of children's books. People assume that if you are a successful writer of books for adults, as I was, that writing for children is something that will also come easily and naturally and that you will be welcomed and that publishers will be keen on you doing. In actual fact, the expression on a children's publisher's face when they hear that somebody who writes books for adults has just decided to write a children's book and is sending it their way combines trepidation, fear, worry, and a kind of almost PTSD thing of, "Oh my God, it's starting again," which is something I didn't learn until after Coraline had come out and been published, and it was sort of confided in me by my children's publisher that they were very worried when they heard that you know, adult author is sending them a book because it's how to be polite and turn down books without offending adult authors is probably some of the trick. So I don't know that I would have, you know, necessarily faced those shoals without having kids and without having the desire to write something that made them think that I'd done something real.
Coraline also explored for animals. She found a hedgehog and a snake skin, but no snake, and a rock that looked just like a frog, and a toad that looked just like a rock. There was also a haughty black cat who would sit on walls and tree stumps and watch her, but would slip away if ever she went over to try to play with it. That was how she spent her first 2 weeks at the house, exploring the garden and the grounds.
You've collaborated with some incredible people over the years. Who else is on your wish list, living or dead?
Oh, living or dead. I'm so lucky because the people I have collaborated with have been the kind of people who I got to not only collaborate with, but I got to learn from. Working with Terry Pratchett on Good Omens was like the ultimate masterclass in novel writing. I've compared it in the past to Michelangelo calling you up and saying, hey, do you want to come over and paint a ceiling with me? It's like, well, yes, actually, I do, and I will learn so much. In terms of people who I'd like to collaborate with, all of my living authors who I love are people who I love to read and have no desire to collaborate with because I want to see what they're going to do. There's definitely a little part of me that wants to collaborate not with Stephen Sondheim now, but I would love to have been an adult in the early 70s and to have worked on a musical of some kind with Stephen Sondheim. That would be absolutely, you know, I can imagine that happening, and I would love to have done that. In terms of everything and everybody out there, it would be fascinating to have got to work with P.G. Wodehouse. It would be fascinating to have worked with W.S. Gilbert. But mostly, even when I start putting these things together in my head, what I start thinking is, but I want to see what you do. You know, would I like to have written with Dickens? No. I like reading Dickens. Writing like Dickens or with Dickens would be fun, but reading Dickens is always much more fun.
So if you had to choose one book from childhood that made you desperate to become a writer, what would it be?
The Narnia series, seven Narnia books, and if I had to get it down to one, it would probably be The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I think what was so important to me was it was the first time I'd really got a sense that there was a writer there and who the writer was. The way C.S. Lewis would put things in brackets, these little parenthetical asides to the reader, that would make you go, oh, somebody is telling me this story, and I think I would probably like the person who is telling me this story. And that point where you're reading the Narnia books, and I got all seven. I originally had read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and then got all of the books for my seventh birthday in a boxed set, and just remember lying on my bed and reading them, and read them over and over for probably the next 3 or 4 years, reading other books too, because there weren't an infinite number of Narnia books, and you can only read all seven books a certain number of times, and also going, you know, and some of the books are not as good as the others. And they've stuck with me. I've read them to my children. So I've now read all of the Narnia books aloud twice, and I'm sure that when Ash turns 6 or 7 or 8, I will read them all to him again. I don't know that I would have been a writer without them, or I don't know that I would have been the writer that I became without them.
There was a boy called Eustace Clarence Scrub, and he almost deserved it. His parents called him Eustace Clarence, and masters called him Scrub. I can't tell you how his friends spoke to him, for he had none. He didn't call his father and mother, but Harold and Alberta. They were very up-to-date and advanced people. They were vegetarians, non-smokers, and teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. In their house, there was very little furniture, very few clothes on the beds, and the windows were always open. Eustace Clarence liked animals, especially beetles, if they were dead and pinned on a card. He liked books, if they were books of information, and had pictures of grain elevators or of fat foreign children doing exercises in model schools.
with on a rainy day. Reread something that's like comfort food for you. Which one would that be?
My comfort reading is very strange because I do have my comfort reading book, and it tends to change with the decades. But the last decade, it's definitely been Henry Mayhew's 1850s study of a set of interviews and descriptions, London Labour and the London Poor. And it sounds dry as dust and probably rather dull. And indeed, every now and again, when he goes off into his analyses of how many oysters, chickens and cabbages were probably sold in London the previous year or whatever, it is rather dull. But mostly it's interviews. And he's going out, I'm assuming, with some kind of stenographer, and or occasionally it's himself in a notebook, probably transcribing afterwards. And he's talking to people and asking them about their lives and their stories, and whether it's boys selling flypaper or street magicians or street singers or costermongers or mudlarks, the children who hang around in the mud underneath the bridge, and the passers-by throw pennies into the mud and the kids dive down and bring it up. And then they also talk about finding bits of coal that have fallen off ships and bringing them in, and lumps of fat, and that's how they're making their living. And it turns into this thing that's like a huge, plotless Charles Dickens novel that just goes on forever in all directions. And it becomes my comfort reading because I read it and start to go, okay, what would it have been to live in that city 160 years ago?
Is it the social history aspect of it that appeals to you, or personal stories?
Personal stories. The social history you get anyway. You know, there's that line when I was growing up, the personal is political. And the personal is political. You can't divorce the people from the politics. But what absolutely fascinates me is you're not talking general lives, you're talking specific lives. And you get a sense with each thing, some of which are just inconceivable. You know, on Hammersmith Bridge, there was a man who set up a thing called a happy family. And the happy family was a bunch of animals who should not have been in the same big glass cage, or in a big glass cage. And you could come past and look at these, you know, here are the mice and the eagles and the cats and the dogs and the monkey and the pigeons, and all of these things are living happily. And he explains how he trains them and how he got this idea and how it happened and how much money he used to get from displaying them, but now everybody's sort of a bit bored of the thing. And you're going, this is a life, which is like every other life, completely unlike any other life.
The street sellers are to be seen in the greatest numbers at the London street markets on a Saturday night. Here, and in the shops immediately adjoining, the working classes generally purchase their Sunday's dinner, and after pay time on Saturday night, or early on Sunday morning, the crowd in the New Cut, and the Brill in particular, is almost impassable. Indeed, the scene in these parts has more of the character of a fair than a market. There are hundreds of stalls, and every stall has its one or two lights. Either it is illuminated by the intense white light of the new self-generating gas lamp, or else it is brightened up by the red smoky flame of the old-fashioned grease lamp. One man shows off his yellow haddock with a candle stuck in a bundle of firewood. His neighbour makes a candlestick of a huge turnip, and the tallow gutters over its sides, while the boy shouting, "Eight a penny, stunning pears!" has rolled his dip in a thick coat of brown paper that flares away with the candle.
Some stalls are crimson with the fire shining through the holes beneath the baked chestnut stove. Others have handsome octahedral lamps, while a few have a candle shining through a sieve. These, with the sparkling ground-glass globes of the tea-dealers' shops, and the butcher's gaslights streaming and fluttering in the wind like flags of flame, pour forth such a flood of light that at a distance the atmosphere immediately above the spot is as lurid as if the street were on fire.
And is there a book that you'd like to recommend for our audience that you've read recently?
You know, I always hesitate to recommend books to audiences because my taste is always my taste. But I will recommend a book which actually was a bestseller and has even been adapted into a TV series, which is, I think, still my favorite book of the last little bit over a decade, which is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke. It really feels like Jane Austen's lost fantasy epic. It's a beautiful, very human, very loving study of two rather awkward people who managed to bring back magic to England. And I recommend it because I think it's a wonderful book, even for people who are certain that they don't like that kind of thing.
Some years ago, there was in the city of York a society of magicians. They met upon the third Wednesday of every month and read each other long, dull papers upon the history of English magic. They were gentlemen magicians, which is to say they had never harmed anyone by magic, nor ever done anyone the slightest good. In fact, to own the truth, not one of these magicians had ever cast the smallest spell, nor by magic caused one leaf to tremble upon a tree, made one mote of dust to alter its course, or changed a single hair upon anyone's head. But, with this one minor reservation, they enjoyed a reputation as some of the wisest and most magical gentlemen in Yorkshire.
My thanks to Hannah and to Neil Gaiman. You can find all of the books of his life, as well as a wide selection of the books that he's written, in the RNIB library. And don't forget, if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks again to Neil Gaiman, Philip Reeve and Hannah Tals. And to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying and your ideas for books that I should read. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, you can find all our previous shows, complete with exclusive author interviews and more, on our Audioboom page. Simply head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other fantastic content from RNIB Connect Radio. So, until next week, thanks for listening, and don't forget to read on.